Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric and Matt, and this is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit, your beacon of freedom and the American way of life. Tune in every Friday for a new episode as we dive into the world of liberty and what makes our country great. All right, guys, this is going to be a great episode. We are going to be diving into our favorite war films.
Amazing.
This is going to be great.
It's I love talking about movies, but war movies in general are super fun.
We hope that everybody is having a great week, and I think this discussion is going to go down some interesting rabbit holes. My favorite war movies might not be what you think. Hopefully there's going to be some surprises in here. Now, I'm sure there's some classic staples that we can all agree are, you know, really, really good war films. Before we get rolling here today, I'd like to give a shout out to the show's sponsor, Koi CBD. They have some amazing CBD products, oils, balms, gummies, flower, all kind of awesome stuff. I love their Delta 8 products. I have terrible back pain, and it really helps with my back pain. They also do some amazing dog treats. So if you've got some dogs that are crazy like mine, or maybe you've got an elderly dog that's got some bad back pain or something, that will definitely help them sleep and get around a lot better. These guys are super veteran and police friendly, really awesome dudes. If you'd like to support them, use the code LLP. That's Lima Papa for you military folks, and you'll receive 15% off. So check them out, Koi CBD. I went on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. I went all over social media, and I let people know that we were going to be doing a war movie roundup. And I asked a lot of our viewers to weigh in. So at some point in the show today, we will refer to some of the comments, and we'll see what some of our viewers' favorite war movies are as well. And we'll weigh in on what our opinions are on those films. So, absolutely. Matt, why don't you start us off? Now, these aren't necessarily in any sort of a particular order. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So don't think that just because we roll to one first that it's necessarily a favorite. We're just going to simply refer to lists here and just sort of go for it.
Yeah. And I'm sure I have more than I would say five, but that's just in case we have some overlap, because I'm sure between the two of us, there's going to be some overlap on movies. What I will tell you is that I really, you know, none of my movies are like modern day war movies. I think it's just like there's a few, like maybe one or two, but I don't know. I think it's just because of, you know, going through what we went through and actually being over there. I don't really get excitement over watching that because like we lived it. So I'm like, there's a lot of stuff that's wrong with it, but also it's just not entertaining for me. I find a lot more entertainment in like the World War II movies or like the Vietnam War movies or even the Korean War movies because I haven't experienced it. So I don't know if it's right or wrong. So,
you know, that's a really good point. And I think that I would also like to just dive into the weeds quickly on just the overall concept of the American psyche of what we think of when we think of war movies. I mean, there is this popular culture phenomenon that has always surrounded war films ever since, you know, people have started to pick up a camera and not only one document actual warfare, like, you know, combat photographers and things like that. But when people want to tell stories, right, film is one of the mediums in which we can tell a story. We can express things in a much more visual way. We can really share these emotions that these soldiers and sailors and Marines are feeling when they're going through these situations. We can more readily tell the evils and travesties that occur, you know, the bad guys, right? So there's all of these stories you can tell with so many forms of emotion and really diving into the minutia of what soldiers go through in combat. And when I think of a good war film, I think of a film that dives into the psychological stresses of warfare in addition, yes, to the physical stresses of warfare. We know warfare is a terrible thing. It's a very ugly thing. But in some cases, it's obviously sometimes a necessary evil. In warfare, people are hurt and it's terrible. People are killed. And there are things that men and women will do to each other you would never think are possible. But when you're put in these situations, there's psychological factors that come into place too. What war makes us feel, what it makes us think, how it changes our worldview, how it changes the way we look at society, the way we look at religion. All of those things can, you know, come into play when it comes to the way a war film will make you change your perspective on a given thing. Whether that war film makes you change your perspective on the war that it takes place during, or, you know, maybe there are war films that are actually anti-war films. Mm-hmm. Which one of my favorite films happens to be an anti-war film, oddly enough. We won't go too far down that rabbit hole yet. But what do you think? I mean, what do war films do to our emotions? Like, how do we emotionally respond to these films?
I mean, you pretty much nailed it. What I think the big thing is that it really allows the general civilian population to at least get somewhat of an idea of what it's like, because you'll never get the 100% view of it. But when they come back, when, you know, anybody comes back from something like that and they try to integrate back into, you know, regular civilian life, it gives you an idea of their decision-making process. Because all veterans that have experienced that go through this decision-making process where it's never as bad as what you experienced. So what other people might say, like, I can't believe you just made a decision like that to do that. Like, well, why not? It's not the worst thing that could happen. So it really changes your decision-making process, your critical thinking ability, all of that changes. And I think the best way that I heard it described was there was a general giving a TED talk. And he described it as, and this is the first time I've heard it expressed this way, there was post-traumatic stress disorder. And then there's also what he referred to as post-traumatic growth. And I've experienced both, but the post-traumatic growth is something that you experience later on in life, like years later. So, you know, when we were over there, we were young guys. And then you come back, we didn't have kids, but now I have a daughter. So you can reflect back on those actions and you go, man, you can take those experiences and you grow exponentially without really having to experience it again. You've experienced it before you really needed to. So now you're at a position where you can really soak it in. It was just an amazing way that he explained it and how you can take both sides of post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic growth, and it really changes you as a person. And war movies, while they are exciting, and even I get amped up when you watch them and you get excited, there are certain emotions that go through you while you're watching these that, you know, you experience.
I think that for me, one of those emotions is usually patriotism.
Yeah.
Especially when it's a war movie related to World War II. You know, my grandpa's generation, the greatest generation, mind you. I would like to piggyback on one thing that you said earlier. And I'd like to recommend a book if you guys would like to read it. It's an excellent book, and it sort of parallels some of these war films we're going to talk about in a way, right? It's a book by Mr. Dave Grossman. It's called On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. It's not a very long read. It's an easy read, and you can get it on Amazon pretty reasonable. It's a great book. It deals with the psychological effects that soldiers go through in warfare when it comes to taking other humans' lives. There's tons of different interviews in that book. And one of the things that, like, they interview, you know, like guys that were on, like, bombing runs in the wars, mm-hmm. and stuff. And, like, a bomber is like, yeah, you know, I just dropped all these bombs. And, you know, no telling how many random people might have died from those bombs dropping. And then hearing the stories from, like, a sniper, for instance, someone who, you know, literally is going to see the whites of the eyes of the person they're about to pull the trigger. Like, there's a more emotional context between, you know, taking a life when you see them, and, you know, it's a harder thing than just dropping a bomb. And so it's a really great book. I would recommend checking it out.
Yeah, I will definitely read that, because that it rings true.
Borrow my copy.
Yeah, thank you. It just rings true, because you had guys, like, imagine Vietnam dropping all, like, just straight napalm on a tree line. Like, man, you know that took out, like, a whole company of dudes, just, like, gone.
So, there's two different types of war film viewers, in my opinion, okay? I think that there is the guy that is super exacting, and he's going to scrutinize every tiny detail. Oh, there's the wrong button on that uniform. Oh, that insignia is wrong.
Right.
Oh, that gun didn't exist in that war. Or, oh, that rifle is the wrong color. That sling is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll admit, I'm one of those kind of people. When I watch a war movie, I totally get in the weeds and I nerd out about every tiny detail when it's something I'm really passionate about. And then there's war movie viewers that glorify the violence and they like the violence. And of course, there's tons of different viewpoints on, you know, war films. But in my mind, there's either that person that's super serious about the details, not to mention the historical accuracy. That's something to keep in mind. Just because you watch a war film, don't assume that the historical accuracy is 110% true. Oftentimes, there's going to be some tiny embellishments. Sometimes they'll add or
more
change up a story a little bit. Like, for instance, Enemy at the Gates, they added the whole, you know, love situation and all. Yeah. So there's going to be some embellishments for Hollywood. Just keep that in mind. So without further ado, with all that said, let's dive into some movies, man.
All right. Let me pull up my list
here.
Yeah,
you start us off, Matt.
So, this might be a bit cliche. I am going to go with Saving Private Ryan. I think it's an excellent movie. It is a timeless classic. You can watch it anytime it's on, whether it's on, like, I'll be flipping through the channels and you're like, Saving Private Ryan is the last 15 minutes. Gotta watch it. You know, or it could be Saving Private Ryan just started, the credits, gotta watch it. You know, it's just one of those movies where you stop, you give it the respect, you watch it wherever it falls in the movie, whether it's the middle part of the movie when they're throwing, like, they're looking through all the dog tags. Okay, so let's just clear one thing up. In that movie, when they're looking through the dog tags of all of the soldiers and they're kind of like sitting in a circle and they're like, holy crap, look at this guy's got like a bullet hole in it. As tragic as that is, that's exactly how it would probably go down. If you had like a bunch of guys, like their mission specific is to find this one dude and they're just like, oh my God, this guy, you know, got whacked, got a bullet hole in it. This one's got like teeth marks in it. It's that dark, crude humor, but that's what they had to do to get them through that moment. That moment, sitting in another foreign country, dude probably just got, one of their buddies just got mowed down by a MG-42 in a cow field. You know, those types of situations exist. And it was just very interesting while you're like going through that movie. Some people are like, I can't believe they did that. That's so disrespectful. It is and it isn't. It is because of what happened, but it isn't because of the situation that they're in. So it's kind of like one of those situation dictates.
I agree completely. That is one of the most true aspects of warfare with soldiers, is that the dark humor that comes out in situations. Sometimes the worse the situation is, the more you have to laugh about it. And they say laugh in the face of danger. I mean, the scene in Saving Private Ryan in the cow field where the medic dies. And yes, it's an MG-42. And, you know, the Germans open fire the MG-42. The medic is mortally wounded. And, of course, there's a very emotional scene there. And to think that you experience these things in warfare and then, all right, that just happened. Like, yesterday we were laughing and joking and drinking coffee and shooting at Germans. And then the next day he's gone. But you know what? We can't stop. We got a war to fight. And that's terrible. You know, it takes a lot of courage to pick the pieces up and move on, despite, you know, putting your emotions on hold. And it can really emotionally affect a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, when you lose a friend in combat, it's not a good thing. So Saving Private Ryan as a movie definitely tells those stories of those relationships between soldiers and each other. And sometimes the strife and the you know, you have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with some people in your platoon, and you can see that in Saving Private Ryan. Not everybody gets along, right? It's a stressful situation. People are trying to kill you. So it is a great movie, and it definitely tells a story of the greatest generation that ever lived, 110%. That movie is a classic. For my purposes, it's not necessarily on my list. I do love that movie, but it's so universally classic and respected that I feel like it's one of those like staples that belongs on everybody's list.
Yeah. I think what made it just so classic-y to me is that it takes you through the entire journey. It shows you, you know, what it's like to be just, yeah, I mean, I know those guys were Rangers, but the way that, I guess the way that that mission was set up is they integrated with just regular ground troops. But you see the entire story from, you're getting a dealt a crappy hand, you have a very specific mission you have to accomplish, it's very chaotic. I love that. That's one of the things I love about war movies, is that it did a really good job of showing the true chaos on the battlefield. It's not, yeah. I mean, and when you think of like all these new modern movies, they make it seem as though everything is seamless and you can talk to the guy next to you and communication on the battlefield is amazing. It sucks. At least it did when we were in, it was hectic, chaotic. And that is what I like. I like that gritty, just get it done.
It definitely tells the story of expectations and warfare never going like you planned.
Yeah.
If it can happen, it will.
Murphy's Law.
It definitely tells Murphy's Law to a T. All right. So quickly, Saving Private Ryan was released in 1998. It was directed by Steven Spielberg. And also, quick note, just a little factoid, a lot of people don't know, there's a lot of young actors in that movie that weren't exactly super famous at the time.
Oh, yeah, man.
Most notably, probably Vin Diesel. A lot of people don't know Vin Diesel's in that movie.
Trying to save that little girl.
He plays Private Capriccio.
Yep.
And he gets shot by the sniper.
Multiple times.
Spoiler alerts, just in case we haven't mentioned already. If you haven't seen some of these movies, there could be some spoiler alerts. We'll try our best not to spoil it. Actually, I'm going to try to do no spoiler on this. Okay. But Vin Diesel, obviously Matt Damon, Tom Hanks plays Captain Miller, Tom Sizemore.
Definitely
yes. Younger. Yeah, he's pretty young in this film.
Dude, he's probably one of my favorite characters in the movie.
Yep. So, great movie. Great choice there, Matt. All right, I'm going to go ahead and go down the rabbit hole on one of my favorite films.
All right.
Now, I can't talk about my favorite. Actually, this might be my favorite war film, if not one of my favorites. But I can't talk about this war film without mentioning Stanley Kubrick and the effect that Stanley Kubrick's work as a director and a filmmaker has had on me as a person. The stories that he tells, the pragmatic approach that he has to using the camera to tell a story, to create a visual atmosphere that draws you in and forces you to see things from his perspective. A lot of films, you have this way of sort of, all right, you're looking at things on the screen and everything. Stanley was such a genius, and he had such a wonderful way of drawing you in and captivating you and forcing you to view each thing as a still life. It's just such a great way of making films, and he has inspired me so much to pick up a camera and try to do things. And we love Stanley, and I love Stanley Kubrick films. I just want to begin by saying that. Full Metal Jacket is a very important movie to me. It was released in 1987.
Love it.
Okay. Now, Full Metal Jacket, just as a film, has created an entire cult following around not only Arlie Ermey, which, you know, who no longer is with us, unfortunately. I've had the luck and privilege to get to work with Arlie Ermey professionally before he passed away. And I got to talk to Arlie Ermey in a fair amount of detail, not a terribly long amount of time, but we had about a 45-minute recess in between filming out in Hollywood, and I was able to kind of chat with him just impromptu, you know, no cameras or recording or anything, but just real impromptu chats about working with Stanley and about, you know, his experience with filming Full Metal Jacket and just his overall thought process. And Ermey told me that, you know, Stanley was definitely a stickler to work for. He always knew exactly what he wanted. Nothing was by chance. He was very, demanding of his actors. He would film the same scene sometimes. I know it's going to be hard to believe, but sometimes hundreds of times. And eyes wide shut, he made Tom Cruise walk through a doorway like 250 times. And it's the most random thing. You would think, well, what is Stanley trying to get? But nothing in a Stanley Kubrick film is not there unless it's for a very specific reason and under a very specific set of circumstances. So Stanley was such a genius. And to hear how much love that Ermey had for Stanley it really makes me love this film even more. After having the talk with Arlie Ermey, I went back and I watched this film again, and it was a little emotional for me because, you know, Arlie Ermey is such a presence when you're in the room with him. So in case you don't know, he plays Gunny Sergeant Hartman. He went into, I don't want to get into the weeds too much on trivia because that's not what this is about, but I will say he went in as a consultant to basically tell the actor how to, you know, draw down these troops and give them heck in basic training, right? But after he started throwing some lines out, they were like, gosh, this guy's such a natural. He was just, his one-liners are so classic. I mean, everything Arlie Ermey says, even when you're talking to him, it's like you just want to record it because his one-liners are just magic, right? So I could see why Stanley, you know, seeing potential in people like he did, saw potential in Arlie Ermey and was like, you know what? Just have him, you know, rip everybody a new one. And let's just roll the camera and just see what the heck happens. And that's kind of what they did. They just ad-libbed it all to a degree. And man, what a classic scene in a movie.
I agree. And I think that you can never emulate or imitate a drill sergeant or a drill instructor without either being one or having some like on set, because their ability to improv and shoot witty one-liners to dumb privates that do dumb things is unimaginable. The creativeness that comes out of their brain, because that is their job, is that you are a drill sergeant or drill instructor paid to wake up at 3:30 in the morning to PT the crap out,
yeah,
and sling insults, slurs, and PT the crap out of privates. That's what you get paid for.
What a job, right?
I know.
So Full Metal Jacket is a magical film for a lot of different reasons. It starts out with this crazy draw up and this training and all. And you think, wow, you know, this film is, what direction is this going? You kind of don't know. Like, yeah, you know, these guys are getting shipped out to Vietnam and they're going to training and everything like that. But it paints this really realistic scenario about what troops go through in training and the psychological effects. One of the soldiers in basic training, or Marines in basic training, obviously goes through a really rough time. I'm not going to spoil it, but let's just say it shows the psychological effects that even training can have on soldiers and how hard military training. Well, I'm not, the training now, you know, they got stress cards and whatnot. We're not going to dive into the weeds on that, but
it's pretty easy.
The drill sergeant punch you in the guts. You know, if he was mad at you, or if you screwed up and did something wrong, you would get some reinforcement by getting kicked in the ribs or punched in the guts or slapped in the face or made to do really, really crappy things. So back then they were really hard on people because they knew they were shipping these young men and women out to Vietnam. And, you know, they knew it was a very sticky situation. And they wanted to make sure they had the best chance of going over there and surviving. Now, another notable actor in this film who is a personal friend of mine is Mr. Adam Baldwin, who plays Animal Mother. Okay, I've worked with Adam in Hollywood as well, and he is such a great dude. Also, just on a personal note, a very good guy overall. Very, you know, conservative values, you know, pro-gun, really good dude. You know, he's definitely our people. So I can really appreciate a guy like Adam, and he's just such a nice guy and very intelligent. And he's a heck of a lot taller than I thought he would be. When I met him in person, I was like, dang, this dude's freaking tall. That was one note. And also Gunny. Gunny's a lot taller than I thought he would
be. So it's the opposite of, you know, the camera adding 10 pounds. It added like 2 feet to him.
Well, that's why they chose Adam Baldwin for that role, because, gosh, he's a freaking animal. Literally, he's a big dude. And, of course, you can't think of Full Metal Jacket without thinking of the scene with him taking the pig and just blasting the building to oblivion. I mean, it's a great scene. It's a classic war scene.
Yep.
And to think that like one of my friends helped make that movie, it's pretty humbling to me, as much of a Stanley Kubrick fan as I am, to have met some of the people that were involved in one of my favorite war films. It's very humbling for me, and it gives me a lot of you know, inspiration to go out and, you know, maybe one day we'll make a war film. I've got some ideas. I'd love to, you know, put some ideas down on paper, and maybe, who knows, maybe eventually you'll see a war film with some credits for me. Who knows? I know that's quite expensive, but we can have that chat at a later time if anybody wants to throw old Eric an email and let's talk about ways we can make a war film. Well, we can go there. But anyway.
We got the props.
Yeah, I digress. Okay, so that's Full Metal Jacket. What's your next one?
Well, let me just touch on Full Metal Jacket. I will just say, and I'll jump to mine. It's a great movie in the sense that, one, it has an amazing director. It's got amazing actors. The storytelling is second to none, but it did a really great job. And I'm a detail kind of guy, especially with war films. It really, really showed, like, it's not all one-sided. Like, there were times where the battle wasn't going their way. Lots of people died. Like the village scenes when they're going into the villages. I mean, those are the types of details that I enjoy watching, because that's not what you would normally see. Normally, it's like a propaganda movie where it's always like one-sided and one side just kind of goes in and steamrolls. But they did a really good job in that movie.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because there are times in the film where you almost want to sympathize with the enemy a little bit. The brutality.
Yeah.
Of the film is second to none. And Stanley did not ever want to hide any of that. He wanted the brutality of war to be present and in your face the entire time. And the film certainly has that effect on you. And there are times where you're thinking, wow, that poor lady, you know, I'm not going to give anything away, but let's just say, you know, it doesn't end well for her. And that scene also has, to nerd out on props, she uses a VZ-58 in that scene, which is really interesting to see that gun in the film. Also, a little bit of trivia on Full Metal Jacket real quick, and we'll move on. The set was actually built in England. So Stanley wanted to build a mini Vietnam in England, and that's what they did to make that movie. So it was actually filmed, mostly on site in England.
I can near see his that. Home. With it being that wet, it's like... Mm-hmm. Raining all the time. It's very wet, marshy. So definitely.
So let's move down the list.
Yep. So my next pick would be a movie that probably isn't on a lot of people's radar. It's called The Great Raid. It is about the liberation from the Ranger Battalion, liberating the Philippine camp. There was a bunch of POWs there. It's, you know, not a very well-known raid, but it's really just a good movie in general. It really showed you, I guess at that time, the black ops or, you know, real guerrilla warfare style of fighting that they had to go through to get to where they're at. And again, it's a spoiler alert. It's not a one-sided thing. People die. As bad as it sounds, if you take it as just being a movie, it's always good when you see both sides take casualties, just because that's the way it happens normally. It's not a one-sided firefight all the time. But also in that movie, there's a scene where they have a time on target and they have to use C4 to take out a bridge. And as much planning and as much preparation went into it, you know, they didn't put enough C4 on the bridge to take it out, which, you know, kind of jeopardized the entire mission, but then they still went through and did the mission. So it's just a very, very dynamic movie. It shows cooperation between the Philippine guerrillas, the Japanese army was, you know, occupying the island. It showed the brutality, but also the coordination between the U.S. like Ranger Battalion and like the Filipino Rangers at the time. And just seeing how those two forces work together to save and liberate these death camps, essentially.
You know, and it's really interesting on the note of that movie, too, to think about how U.S. Special Forces works now with indigenous populations. And, you know, mm-hmm. they will embed themselves within those populations and they'll train them and they'll learn their ways. And a lot of times they'll learn the language and the culture. And there's been a lot of situations where, you know, U.S. troops have integrated themselves into a culture and even, you know, achieved leadership-like status in the community. And mm-hmm. I think that says a lot about those concepts. Watch it. That says a lot about those concepts, you know, where you can get in there and really become a member of the community. And what better way to work with the locals than to actually train and live with them? So there's a lot of that goes into war films for sure. The brutality is always something that is going to be a part of war films. And I know some folks are squeamish, but we're going to get into some other movies. But there certainly are some movies that have a lot of violent scenes in them. You know, I don't think so. The Great Raid, that movie you mentioned, I'll have to go back and watch it. I do recall seeing it, but it's been quite a while. I don't think I've seen it in a bit.
I'll tell you, you know where you saw that movie at first. I'll tell you, I know exactly where you were at.
Where?
You were laying on a green cot in a tent in Baghdad. Because that is where we watched it on bootleg DVD in Iraq that we bought from the local market.
So make sure you get the bootleg version of The Great Raid. It may say The Great Raid.
Yeah. if you don't see like people's heads moving around, then you didn't get the right one.
That's
you
right.
You got to see the people get up and walk around. But that was, I remember because we got the bootleg right when it came out. And that's where we watched it as a platoon.
Bootleg yep. Bizarre movies for the win.
Yep. But then I watched it a couple times after that, like the actual like paid version was good.
I'm going to go back and watch it. Okay. We're going to go on to one of my favorite war films. And I don't think that you can have a list of favorite war films without having 1964's Zulu. All right. I'm going to give a little bit of backstory here because there might not be a lot of folks that know what happened and everything like that. This is like a Victorian era type of thing. So it's definitely older battles. Notable actors in this film, Nigel Green, Color Sergeant Bourne. Also Michael Caine, a very young Michael Caine. If you guys, don't know who Michael Caine is, you remember Austin Powers, Austin Powers' father in the Austin Powers films. That's Michael Caine. And he's been in a ton of other, Bond movies, all kind of stuff. He's a legend.
Totally left out the Batman series.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. And he
was Alfred.
He plays Alfred, but a legend. I mean, just a gentleman and a legend. I absolutely adore Michael Caine's acting. And it doesn't matter what role he's in. He just creates this aura and you just want to listen to him. And he is just such an awesome guy. All right, so I'll just quickly give a little bit of backstory about Zulu, and I'm just going to go off the Internet Movie Database because that gives me a little bit of a synopsis. This comes out of 1879. The British are fighting the Zulus, and one of their columns has just been wiped out in Aswanda. The Zulus next fix their sights on a small British outpost at Yorks Drift. I guess you pronounce that with a Y, Yorks Drift. At the outpost are 150 British troops under the command of Lieutenants Bromhead and Shard. In the next few days, these 150 troops will fight about 4,000 Zulu troops in one of the most courageous battles in history. So this battle, Yorks Drift, it was such a crazy battle. And without getting into the historical context, the movie comes really, really close to getting a lot of things right. But it is a classic war film. It's filmed really well. The actors do a great job of making you really want to believe what the troops are going through and the experiences. Of course, I love the Martini Henry rifle. So for me, obviously they use a ton of martinis. Mm-hmm. And there are references to the martinis. Obviously, they're firing them in ranks, which is really cool. The parts where they're cracking open the cases of martini ammo. And it's just such a cool type of film. I mean, literally circling the band, the bandwagons, making a little corral, making a defensive position. Right. They go through and they make their defensive positions. They reinforce their positions. They have to deal with triage and taking care of sick and wounded. I mean, all of those things are sort of covered and talked about. Also, the emotional responses of soldiers in combat. Even back then, sure, men carried themselves with a different degree of honor than what they do today. People were very honorable back then. But you still see these moments in Zulu where, button your tunic like a good chap. They're having to, that drill and ceremony aspect even of, getting in formation and soldiers goofing around and giving the sergeant a hard time and, the sergeant getting on to people about combing their hair and keeping up their appearance. I mean, even though you're surrounded by 4,000 angry men with spears and shields, and you've got guns, sure, but you've got 4,000 men around you.
That's a lot of men.
And you still have the thought process to, be a good chap and button your tunic. So it's like they had such respect for the uniform and for each other and for the presence of their home country that they still maintain that discipline. Now, of course, in the film, that discipline begins to break down, as war often makes us sort of forget the formalities of being in the rear and get more into the survival instinct. Some soldiers in the film handle it better than others. I won't spoil it, but it's a great film, and it's very historically accurate. It does a great job of telling what, or showing a visual representation of what happened at York's Drift.
I've never seen the movie, but the way that you described the breakdown in, you know, customs and courtesies, and the breakdown in camaraderie, I guess you could say, the men kind of breaking ranks and not doing what they're supposed to be doing. You know, we've experienced that even in the modern day Army. You go out and you do a couple missions and you're out for a couple of weeks and you come back, you have to kind of reacclimate yourself to the customs and courtesies of being back at the rear, because you're used to operating a little bit more autonomously when you're out there on the mission. So, I mean, I can only imagine being, you know, completely surrounded by 4,000 people that want to absolutely murder you.
Oh, yes.
And still worrying about a tunic.
So, like, those men, that situation ended up being potentially what would have been a last stand. They were prepared to make their last stand. I won't give anything away. You should watch the film. It's great. A little trivia really quick. British casualties, they lost 32. The Zulus' casualties were roughly 851 men. So the Zulus lost almost a fourth of their fighting force almost attacking 25%. Their position. And of course, it really blossomed patriotism for the Brits at the time. That was a huge win for them, because it was like, yeah, you know. And I won't get into any of the historical weeds or any of the details of the movie, but you should definitely check out Zulu. It is a great film.
I'm definitely going to go check that out. I am going to say Fury. I liked Fury. I didn't like Fury, you know, as this great storytelling, you know, immersive, in-depth movie. I liked it for what it was. And it was a dark, dirty, gritty war movie. And I think that personifies what it was like to be with a group of people that they could tolerate each other, but they didn't get along. And you saw that on the tank. So you had Brad Pitt, that was the tank commander, and he had like his little bow gunner. The first one got blown to bits, so he got thrown another bow gunner, and he was a little, you know, halfway crazy. You could see it. Like he was like sitting next to a tamed tiger. Sure, the tiger will sit there if he's happy, and he'll listen to you, you know, maybe. But
what if he gets hungry?
But there's always that he turns around and just claws you right in the face. You don't ever know. He's a wild animal. Yeah. And that's what it was like in the movie. You had the tank commander, and he had like three, you know, tame animals in there with him. And he's like telling them to do stuff, hoping that they would listen, you know. And if they decided to listen, great, you know. And that was seen in the scene where they met the two young ladies in their bombed out apartment, and they're cooking dinner, and they kind of crash the party, and they get a little bit crazy, and he was able to tame them back down as a tank crew, but they were just one smidge away from doing what they weren't supposed to be doing. So that whole movie was like that, and that's what it always made you wonder, like, oh, what's gonna happen. And it was just a great movie.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned Fury, because Fury didn't necessarily make it into my list. But since you mentioned it, that's awesome, because I get to talk about it. And I wasn't sure if I was going to get to talk about this film or not. I agree. The one common denominator between this film and what the glue that holds this film together, dirt.
Yes.
Dirtiness. Both philosophically and physically. And war is a dirty place. You're dirty all the time. You're sweaty. You're nasty. You know, the smells, the sounds, you know, just the personal feeling of really, really great discomfort. Okay. Mm-hmm. You can really feel that in Fury, right? Imagine you're rolling around in this giant death box with four smelly dudes that probably smell like farts and everything else, right?
Yep.
You know, it's just, it does a great job of really putting you into the idea of understanding the sights and the smells and the sounds and the dirt and the grit and the just gross nature of warfare. Probably the most memorable scene for me in Fury is when they run over the dead German soldier with the tank. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, it's not like they go out of their way to do it. The poor German soldier, of course, was just dead in the road.
He couldn't move.
Can't help where he died, right? So to think that we as people, you would think, okay, if there were a person who passed away in the road, for instance, out here and got in a car wreck, you wouldn't unceremoniously drive over their corpse to keep going. You know, you would stop and move the corpse and respectfully tend to the deceased. That's what civilized people do. It shows the uncivilized nature of combat in that you're a young man driving a tank and you're going to run over a corpse because you don't have time to get out and move it, or because the people outside the tank might kill you, and you're forced to accept that reality. And that scene happened so quick, you're like, what did I just watch?
Yeah.
And it makes you realize how sudden warfare is and how necessary warfare is in terms of your actions. You do things that you wouldn't do in a civilized environment. You wouldn't do in the real world. War is a microcosm of evil and death and dirt and destruction, both philosophically and physically. And Fury tells that story better than probably any other war film.
And if I remember correctly, there's also a scene where a German tank runs over a German soldier by mistake, if I remember correctly, like, because they're trying to beat feet, that enemy tank's trying to get out of there too. Yeah. And the guy just didn't get out of the way, and Tom was like, just right over him.
War is ugly, and Fury tells that ugliness with probably the type of consequence that you almost wish you could take back, but you can't.
Yeah, I agree.
Write that down. You're listening, Siskel and Ebert. Write that down. Okay. All right. We're going to go on to my next war film here, and this is 1979, Apocalypse Now.
Such a good one.
Oh, what such a movie. Good movie. Now, I don't want to get in the weeds on this, but I love this film. It is awesome.
It's great for just being really, really just off the rails. Like, it's so... The thing, and this is not, well, Apocalypse Now kind of personifies this, but the level of just off the book stuff that took place in Vietnam is astronomical. Like, it was like to have just a random government agent come in and say, hey, we're going to have you taken out of your unit and we're just going to insert you into Cambodia to do some weird secret squirrel stuff.
Yeah.
In today's military, that's impossible. You know how much paperwork you got to fill out to do a transfer of unit over there? It's like paperwork didn't exist. They could literally just go and pull a guy out and just, you would never see him again.
So the storyline synopsis is pretty long. I'm not going to bother reading this, but I'll just give you an idea here. A U.S. Army officer serving in Vietnam is tasked with assassinating a renegade special forces colonel who sees himself as a god. Oh my freaking god, dude, you're setting up like the most crazy war film ever made. Like, yeah. What? Yep. Like, you oh my, what
that I mean,
like, how can you read that and not want to instantly just take notes? Like, yeah. What is about to happen here? That is setting up one crazy war film.
Yeah.
And it is one doozy of a war film.
It's a masterpiece, dude. Like, I will say it definitively, like, that is an absolute masterpiece of a movie.
So who is this crazy colonel? None other but Marlon Brando. Now, we're going to get into some of the production notes, things that I remember, but I'll also refer to some stuff. Also, Martin Sheen is mm-hmm. in this film. He does a fantastic job playing Captain Benjamin Willard. He is the assassin that is tasked with going to seek out Colonel Kurtz. All right. Robert Duvall. yes.
Yeah, I do.
Love that man. Also, another notable actor two notable actors. A lot of people don't realize this was a really, really, really early role for both Harrison Ford and for Lawrence Fishburne. You guys know Lawrence Fishburne. what a legend. Matrix. I mean, he's been in so many great films, obviously, you know, and also the John Wick series. I mean, Lawrence Fishburne is a household name and a legend in the movie industry.
That's right.
But what an awesome dude. And of course, it goes without saying, Harrison Ford, look what he went on to do.
I don't remember seeing him in that movie.
Harrison Ford is a very young photojournalist and radio operator in the film, I believe. Yeah. Man. Here they list him as Colonel Lucas. In the film, I believe Harrison Ford was a radio operator or worked in the talk. Yeah.
I remember.
And he's in a brief scene, but he isn't there.
I remember Lawrence Fishburne. They were like kind of in the bunker, like drinking beer and stuff like that. Yeah. Drinking beer. What a great movie. Film. Just the when you look at it from a strictly logistics, I guess, viewpoint, and this is why I love Vietnam era movies so much. It's because when you think about going into a war zone, the freedom of movement that they have within that country is crazy. When you have this idea that they can just jump on a Huey, I need to go to so-and-so fire base, and they'll just like, okay, and they just pick him up and they leave. That's unheard of now. You would never be able to just walk onto a C-130 and say, hey, I got to go to J-Bad, or I have to go to Baghdad, or, you know, Talil. Like, I have to go. They're not going to be like, where's your paperwork?
Yeah, the red tape was certainly much more removed in a war like Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And Apocalypse Now tells it in this way that you could just absolutely not expect in any other way to occur. I mean, it shows the story of Vietnam as being a bunch of unwilling participants. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to paraphrase. I don't have exact quotes in front of me, but throughout the movie, Colonel Kurz, this person that views himself, Kurtz. This man that views himself as this god, right? He takes up this residence up the river in Cambodia, has this group of people that become his followers. And even he ends up claiming and writing in some of his memoirs, which, of course, Martin Sheen's character, Captain Willer, goes through in the film, where he's like, if you gave me a dedicated force of soldiers who were trained and dedicated and that I could direct them to do what I needed to do, I could win this war in 3 weeks. It's a pretty bold statement. Now, I'm paraphrasing. Those aren't his exact words. But he essentially claimed that with a more dedicated force of well-trained people, Kurtz in the film, Marlon Brando's character, is clearly disgusted at the military's ability to just interject a bunch of green troops into this. Remember, Brando was Brando's character, Kurtz, was a very seasoned soldier, mm-hmm. right? He understood what well-trained soldiers could do when placed into a situation where they're given a free pass. Basically, the way that the colonel approached this war, the Vietnam War, he wanted to take cells of men and insert them into places to literally exact utter and complete chaos on the population, and that's how he was going to win the war. And honestly, that's a pretty hot take. I would say he's absolutely correct. I'm not going to get into the weeds, but that's a good point.
Well, even in the modern day, like the actual what the mission set was for Special Forces or MACV at the time in Vietnam was exactly that, inserting into Laos and Cambodia and doing those types of missions, maybe not at the scale that they talked about in the movie about just doing scorched earth across there to get what they wanted to get out of it. But the movie, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend watching it. There, you'll probably see so much pop culture throughout that movie, and then you would have found the source, because that movie is kind of the standard of like all of these little pop culture meme clips that you see. They all came from these older movies.
Marlon Brando is such a force.
Yep.
He was such a force in that film. Like you hang on every word he says. He tells a story without speaking. I mean, every moment that Marlon Brando fills that screen, you are filled with absolute dread. There's this dreadness to the situation, to his presence, that makes you even question your own humanity. It's crazy. It is one of the best war films ever. Now, obviously, it is a work of fiction. Okay, I don't think it's based on any true historical fact that we know of. But a fantastic film. Go ahead, Matt.
All right. So,
whoa, I'm getting emotional to think about it. Like, it is such a great film. It is. I'm going to go watch it after
that scene with the river where it's like, you know, the way they do the lighting, it's like black, but you have like red over like overlay, but then you still see a little bit of like artillery fire and like you just see tracers. Like, every, like, it's crazy. Every, like, just random 30 seconds, you'll see like a couple of tracers fly in the background. Yeah. You're like, what?
The film is an acid trip.
Yeah.
The film puts upon the viewer the feeling of being a person who is interjected into such a horrible situation that the horror of the environment makes you trip and enter a different world, an environment that mankind doesn't exist in.
Yep.
Further, as he progresses into the film, Charlie Sheen's character, he becomes more and more mad. And he begins to find out what drove the colonel mad.
Yep. Yeah. It's crazy.
You transcend into a trip and you don't know if you're ever going to come back. And you feel like the further and further you go in this film that you won't be able to come back. And then you understand why the colonel didn't come back.
He starts to empathize with them. So he starts saying, well, maybe he's right. Maybe, you know, I'm the bad guy. Like, it's like this complete, like, journey of self-discovery almost.
He transcends from a model soldier to a model human.
Yes.
And it is a very breathtaking thing to view. It is such a great film.
Yep.
Anyway. Sorry.
So, no, it's hard to find a better war movie than that. So I would probably put that as number one of all time for me.
So let's do one more of yours, and then we're going to go over some viewers because we're actually getting close on time here.
Absolutely.
So let's dive into one of yours.
So, such a hard one. I got so many here, but I'm trying to go with the one that I would like. So the wild card, I'll treat this as my last one. It's a wild card. It's actually a Korean movie that was released in U.S. theaters. It's the top grossing Korean movie of all time. It's called Taeguki. And I watched this when it first came out. And it's a Korean movie produced, acted based on the Korean War from their side. So not the American side. So you'll always see, like, you know, the Forgotten War movies or Korean War movies that are American produced. And they're showing like the American side of how they participated. There's like maybe one or two showing the Korean outlook or the Korean view. And it's just, you know, about these two brothers. Like, it's kind of like a story of two brothers getting separated and then one going to fight for the north side after his brother was killed by, you know, the own government. It's like so many different loopholes. But you get to see like the Korean army interact with the U.S. army fighting North Korea and China and all that stuff. It's really, really a great movie. And it follows these two brothers from when they were like kids, like, you know, 7 or 8 years old, all the way to being like generals in, you know, the army of either side. Yeah, it's really crazy.
Wow. And you know, I've never heard of that film. I'm going to check it out. And yeah. I love films that tell the story from the situation of folks that would generally say, oh, that's someone I don't care about in the war, or that's someone that's the enemy. Like, I always love films that are told from a different perspective because it really shows the struggles that everyone goes through in warfare. I mean, just because a person might not have been on the right side of humanity in war doesn't mean that the person involved in the war doesn't want to, you know, live and survive and has to be a soldier and has to survive. So now, if I'm to understand correctly, now we're talking South, during the Korean War, there was really no such thing as South and North Korea.
Correct.
Right?
It was Korea. Right? It was Korea, a unified Korea, and then starting in Busan, which is the coast on the southern coast, it's like our Florida version, like Miami. Think Miami, it would be like Busan. It's at the very bottom of the peninsula.
I want to visit Busan.
Oh, yeah. No, you don't. It's a fishing village. Or used to be, at least. They pushed all the way from the southern tip all the way up to almost into China. And then China was like, well, you know what? I think we want to help these guys out. And they... between the Chinese and the North Korean, 99% Chinese, they pushed them back to the 38th parallel, which is like in the middle of Korea. And that's kind of where the line is between North and South. Yeah. But along those lines, a lot of families got separated. A lot of troops got separated. But the brothers got separated when they were younger, and one ended up staying in North Korea and joining the North Korean army. And this is fiction, by the way, so it's not. It's a great movie, great story.
But there certainly are situations that probably has some element.
I think it's happened, you know, throughout time as war happened in general. Like, you know, whether it was, you know, the Confederate and the Union, lots of families split there, some by choice, many not. You know, even in like Vietnam, South Vietnam, North Vietnam, Myanmar, all kinds of countries.
What a great point.
Yeah.
All right, so I'd like to end by going through a few of our viewers' suggestions. I'll quickly give our honorable mentions that we don't have time to get into. We will do another episode and dive into the weeds on some of these other movies. All right, quickly for me, 1978, The Deer Hunter. I love that film.
Yep.
2013, Lone Survivor, one of my favorite films.
Mm.
2001, Black Hawk Down. Love that film. Great film. All right, you?
Yep. I would say... I don't know if this qualifies as a war movie. I think it's a war movie. Top Gun, starring Maverick and Goose. Great movie. Crimson Tide with Denzel Washington. Great movie as well. And I know those don't qualify as like full-on war movies, but when I think like war movie / military, that's very similar. God, Enemy at the Gates was a great movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't make like my top five, but man, that movie is so great. Just the cinematography that goes into it, the storytelling. And yeah, that part was all kind of made up with the love story, but the cat and mouse that actually happened, that was, I mean, I've read books and like that, like legit, they're looking for like, oh, it's a piece of trash that moves in the rubble. Like that's where he's at. And he just,
that does tell a very interesting story. And Jude Law's performance in that movie is fantastic, by the way. All right, we're going to go through a couple. All right, so quickly, I'm going to go through some Twitter comments. Okay, Steve Adams says, mine would be Saving Private Ryan, Dunkirk, Glory, 1917, and The Hurt Locker.
God, Glory was a good one, too. Man.
Absolutely.
Thanks. That was, and I'm probably going to go watch that.
Okay, so Will, well, you gave me 10 movies here, Will. All right, so Will Cruz says, Saving Private Ryan, Black Hawk Down, The Last Samurai, Lone Survivor, Das Boot. I've seen that movie.
It's a good one.
Full Metal Jacket, Glory, Last of the Mohicans. Yeah, that's a war movie.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Patton, and then The Outlaw, Josie Wells. Infidel says Hamburger Hill.
God, that was a good one, too.
Yes, it was.
Jeez.
I've actually got a lot of ones here. Braveheart. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's Twitter. We're going to slide on over up to the gram here, and we're going to see what people are saying on the gram. Give me a second here.
This is like taking me down memory lane with all these.
That's right. All right, so Do It With Dan. He said, that scene in Saving Private Ryan where the guys are dying and calling for his mom in particular makes my stomach turn every time. Not my favorite by far, but a good scene. Rock Island Auction says, bruh, you better get Saving Private Ryan on that bad boy. I've never seen Zulu, though, so I'm granting you some leeway. Fair. That's fair. All right. Let's see here. Enemy at the Gates. I'm looking for lists. Hang on. Let's give me a second here. Many, many people are saying that Saving Private Ryan.
It's quintessential. Quintessential. I will say that scene where the medic gets hit and he's crying, I think he was actually also trying to talk him through how to save his own life. I didn't quite get it, but...
What a soldier, right? I mean, okay, so Flex Era says Black Hawk Down, Apocalypse Now, Platoon, Full Metal Jacket,
Platoon,
and The Hunt for Red October. Man, Platoon
is... man.
I didn't have a chance to discuss Platoon, but I love the psychological action in Platoon as well. You know, when soldiers start thinking about, well, maybe on this next raid, I'll just try to... grease my buddy so I don't have to deal with him.
Yep. Tigerland. Oh, there's another one. Tigerland was a good one, too.
All right, we're going to slide over to Facebook because I asked some of you on Facebook. Give me 1 second here. I'm just going to pull up and see what some of my Facebook followers said. Give me a second here, y'all.
Saving
Wow, 408 comments. I know. I don't have time to go through all of them. I'm just going to do a little random. All right. I'm looking for...
So I heard a lot of glory in there. So a lot of people are digging the glory.
Hang on, I got to refresh these comments. Give me 2 seconds, y'all. All right, we're going to go through here. All right, Vic Harris says, the Green Berets with John Wayne, The Patriot with Mel Gibson, The Patriot. Ah, what a great movie.
That's a good one, too.
The Dirty Dozen, Tora, Tora, Tora. Those are great great choices, Vic. Mm-hmm. All right, Dylan Quinn says, Saving Private Ryan, Hacksaw Ridge, War Horse, American Sniper. Yeah.
American Sniper. The book was great. I didn't really dig the movie, but the book was really good.
Enemy at the Gates, 1917. Mm-hmm. All right, Ethan Story says Platoon, Apocalypse Now, The Thin Red Line, Braveheart, The Patriot, Heartbreak Ridge. Those are excellent choices. This guy says, Richie says, Star Wars.
I mean, he's not wrong, you know.
Well, that's fictional. That hasn't happened yet. Or maybe it's already happened. Maybe it was in the past.
Maybe that was in the second simulation, but I think we're on like the sixth now.
We're on number three. Yeah. All right, one more here. All right, Jim Lewisell says Zulu, Heartbreak Ridge, Sahara, Hacksaw Ridge, and Patton.
Wait, Sahara, doesn't that have Matthew McConaughey in it?
I think it does.
That's not a war movie.
Is it?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm going to have to fact check that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure on that. All right, I really enjoyed this episode.
Yeah, this one was fun.
Hope y'all liked it. And this is some of our favorite war films. We're probably going to wind up doing another episode on war films because there are so many great films that I wanted to talk about in detail. I didn't have really a chance to. So we will revisit this particular podcast in the future and dive into the weeds a little bit more in more detail on some of our favorite films. So, thank you very much. Have a great week. We appreciate the support of LLP. Go over to Ballistic Ink and pick yourself up a snazzy t-shirt like the one that Matt here is wearing and other similar fantastic designs. You can support our podcast and channel by doing that. If you're watching on YouTube, thank you very much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed it. So we post a lot of these on YouTube as well as obviously our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all the top podcast serving outlets.
Anywhere podcasts can be heard.
That's right. So have a great week. We will see you next Friday. We post every week here on Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit. We hope you enjoyed it. Have a wonderful week. Live free. Be happy. We'll see you soon.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. You can support us over on Ballistic Ink by picking yourself up some merch. And remember, guys, dangerous freedom. Have a good one.